Welcome to Here in LA, Pacific Palisades edition. Today we talk with Peter Viles. Peter is a fantastic journalist, a husband, and a father of three who is able to escape the Palisades fire with his kids and his pets. But like the great actor of Cocoon, Steve Guttenberg, experienced, Pete was nearly stymied at the end of his road as there was a major bottleneck which caused panicked Palisaders to ditch their cars and hoof it. Unlike many of his neighbors, even some on his block, Pete's house is still standing, but it's severely spoke damaged, which forced he and his family to rent a house pretty far away. So we will talk about his escape, the toll even people whose homes survived the fire but are far from 100% are experiencing, what his kids are going through, and also what life was like for he and his family before the fire upended what seemed to be the dream neighborhood in a perfect spot. So here we are with Peter Viles. Hey everybody, I am here talking with Peter Viles of the Palisades. Hey Peter!
Tony!
Peter and I got to know each other 13 years ago, 14 years ago?
It's 07, so that means it was closer to 18 years ago.
Jeez, mama mia.
I know, right?
Does it feel that long ago to you?
Well, sometimes it does, you know, on days when everything hurts and I'm like, oh my God. But other times it feels like it was yesterday.
So Peter and I met because I was overseeing the blogs at the LA Times. Pete already had a real estate blog. And it was doing great. What was it called, Pete?
It was called L.A. Land.
L.A. And, Land.
Before we go too far, I have sort of like La La Land, but just La
Land.
Yeah,
yeah.
Before we go too far, Tony is one of the best bosses I ever had.
Oh, God bless you.
You gave me a lot of rope and a lot of encouragement. And anytime I wanted feedback, you gave it to me. But it was almost always positive. You're more of a coach than a boss.
In your situation, I feel like I was more of a cheerleader. I don't think you needed a coach. You wrote your tail off. You engaged with people in the comments. You did your research. You're a smart guy, and you're a good writer. It was fun, and
I was lucky because I started writing this blog about the residential housing in LA, like 6 or 8 months or before the housing market blew up with the, you know, the mortgage crisis and everything. So I had sort of hit my stride right at the time when the story became front page news.
Yeah. And you had a lot of insightful points of view. Like I remember very, very clearly that you said, as Highland Park goes, so goes LA. And here we are years later and you were right on the money.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a fun and interesting time. What was, you know, and we've talked about this before, but at the time we didn't own a house and the discussion about housing was really divided between the owners and the renters, where the owners were like, oh, this is just the way the world works. And the renters were like, this is unsustainable. This is unfair. This is a bubble that's going to burst. Mm-hmm. And at that moment in time, the renters were correct.
Right. Right. And so you ended up with this dream house in the Pacific Palisades, you and your wife and your three kids. And when I visited you and you walked me around the house and you walked me around the neighborhood, we took a little hike in that beautiful lush area that surrounded your home. It was very inspiring to watch, Pete, because you and your wife manifested the dream house, the American dream house, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't set out to do it. It just sort of happened. We were living in Mar Vista in a little rented house, and we put our youngest child in kindergarten at a private school in the Palisades just because it seemed like a really solid education. And, you know, our kids are in public school now, but at the time we weren't certain we wanted to go to the public school in our neighborhood. Anyway, we would drive every day from Mar Vista to the Palisades to drop them off, which is kind of a long drive. And then so one day we finally said, well, let's look for, you know, what this neighborhood is like. And there's one neighborhood in the Palisades. It's really, I wouldn't say it's affordable, but it's the least expensive part of the Palisades. And it is more affordable than most of Venice and most of Santa Monica. And so we started looking in that neighborhood. And this foreclosed townhouse became available. This is 2010. And my wife is like, we've got to jump on this. It's in foreclosure. We'll get a good price. And I was like, listen, nobody moves to Los Angeles to live in a townhouse. Can you trust me on this? And of course, I was wrong, and she was right. And we bought this townhouse, and we were very happy in it for like 5 years. And then at that point, the real estate market had started a big comeback. And in 2015, we sort of had enough equity in the townhouse to sell it and then have enough money to make a down payment on a single family house, which is the house you saw.
Wow. Wow. Is,
you don't know how good you have it until you don't have it anymore.
I mean, right.
that neighborhood was close to perfect.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time when we were living on that street, and my oldest son's best friends lived like five doors one direction, and they hung out in their garage like all the time, listening to rap music and lifting weights and playing Minecraft and all the rest of it. And he was over there all the time. My daughter's best friend lived one block over, and she used to walk over there all the time. And then my youngest son, his best friend lived at the top of the hill, and he'd walk up.
Mm-hmm.
So all three of our kids had best friends that could walk over to their house. That's pretty rare in LA. Usually a kid needs a ride to a play date.
Right.
And, it was great. It was great.
What else is very storybook and almost fictional is how your family embraced the Palisades, and how you've got a son who's the quarterback of the JV football team at Pali High.
Yep.
Your kids got into golfing and surfing, and the pictures that you would take of them going down the hill and going to were you guys surfing right there at the end of your road, basically?
Well, I mean, it's 2.5 miles or 3 miles from our road down to the beach.
Mm-hmm.
All three of our kids learned to surf in the Palisades. This is the part of the podcast where I get to brag about my family. But let me back up a second, though. If you live in L.A. and you don't have children and you go to the Palisades, you're like, what is this strange place? There's not much to do there. There aren't many restaurants there. I still don't think there's a single bar in the Palisades. It's not like a destination. I mean, there's some good hiking there, but if you're young and bopping around town, it's like you go there and you're like, well, what's so special about this place? And we felt that way until we had three kids, and then we'd go over there and it was just like, this place feels like, you know, Mayberry. Everybody's got kids and everybody plays Little League baseball and soccer, and you know, it was a perfect place to raise kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is an affluent community, and you have to be, you know, concerned about whether your kids are growing up with too much privilege and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If that's your main problem raising kids, you know, you're in a pretty good spot, and you've got kind of one thing to focus on.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, it is kind of idyllic. There's a little beach. It's actually a big beach. Will Rogers State Beach goes from, you know, the Palisades all the way down to Santa Monica.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one surf break in the middle of that beach, and it's a perfect surf break for beginners. It's never very big. It's a beach break. You know, on the biggest day, it's going to be 2.5, 3 feet. And it's a great place for kids to learn how to surf. And all three kids learned how to surf there. My wife, who is also a surfer, taught them how to surf.
I didn't know she was a surfer.
Yeah, she's a very good surfer. She's a longboarder and just sort of likes to go out there and, you know, catch waves. She'll catch waves for 70 or 80 minutes.
Wow.
Never 40 and never 2 hours. right? But it was idyllic for us. I mean, it was close. And then there's also this summer sports program in all the beach communities in L.A. called Junior Lifeguards. And all of our kids did that program. Our kids have done every single sport under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Junior lifeguards is the best sport they've done. There's zero parental involvement. There's no winners and losers.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pass fail. You have to go almost every day for like 6 weeks. If you miss too many days because you don't feel like going, you're not going to pass.
Mm.
And the ultimate pass fail is, every day you swim a little further in the ocean. You swim in the ocean without a wetsuit.
Oh.
Every day you swim a little further. And towards the very end, they have a buoy swim. We have to swim between two buoys, out to a buoy and then across to a buoy and then back in. And it's, you know, it's a distance that would have been mind-boggling 6 weeks earlier for that kid. It's a real test of endurance and grit.
Mm-hmm.
And almost all the kids pass it. Almost all the kids come out with this great feeling of accomplishment that you don't always get from, you know, soccer or Little League baseball or whatever else it is.
That's right.
There's no trophies or anything, but it's a great sport. And our kids did that for years at the Will Rogers Safety.
And I bet for parents like you, now you have this great confidence that they're safe in the ocean, you know?
Oh, completely safe in the ocean. And our oldest, Campbell, is a good enough, strong enough swimmer. If he wanted to, I'm sure he could pass the lifeguard test. But he was out there surfing one day, and there's a jetty there. When you first get there, you say, how are these people surfing so close to the jetty? But it's all these rocks. It's not dangerous. The current doesn't take you toward it. But there was one day when the ocean was really angry, and this guy got kind of stuck over there and was having a hard time basically getting away from the rocks, and he wasn't a strong swimmer. Kim just looked at him, took about 8 giant strokes, and grabbed him and pulled him away. And that's what, you know, junior guards will do for kids. You become extremely confident and very capable in the ocean.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. So, this new neighborhood, does it have a name?
Yeah.
What's your neighborhood?
Yeah, it's called the Highlands.
The
palace has, say, about 8 neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And the one that is, you know, really, really exclusive, where the celebrities live, where Ronald Reagan used to live and Nancy Reagan, is called the Riviera. And that's the one, I think Jennifer Garner lives up there. And it's very private. Everybody has these really, really tall hedges. And that's actually, that area was not touched by the fires.
Obviously. Yeah. Huh.
But you know, that's the most expensive. If you wanted to spend $25 million on a house, that's where you could go and spend it. Our neighborhood is called the Highlands, and it's got condos, townhouses, and single family houses. And at the very upper reaches of the hill that we're on, there are some gated neighborhoods.
Mm.
I think James Worthy lived up there like in the 80s or 90s.
Big game James. Good for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, what kind of damage did the Highlands experience with the fire?
You know, it's really strange because the Palisades fire started in the Highlands.
Oh.
And the Highlands is, it's splashed out across this hillside that runs up a canyon. And it's about, I don't know, there must be 1,000 houses in the Highlands.
Mm.
And it just runs up the hill. It's always sunny up there. The marine layer never gets up there. And it is surrounded on all 4 sides by a state forest.
Mm.
And I had always thought, you know, there's a risk that one day this neighborhood is going to burn down because we're close to these fires, the forest. So the fire started in the Highlands, and then it moved directly away from the Highlands.
Mm-hmm.
It went straight down the hill, not down the hill where the houses are, but down in a different direction, straight to the Palisades Village. And the neighborhood that was most completely destroyed is the one right in the middle of the town that's called the Alphabet Streets. The first street is A, and the second street is B, and the third street is C. And that neighborhood was like, I don't know, 90% destroyed. I would say the Highlands was 20 or 30% destroyed. I'm guessing there were entire portions of it that weren't touched.
Mm-hmm.
The townhouse neighborhood where we used to live was almost untouched.
Oh, good.
And some of the areas that are called the Lower Highlands, where you're not at the top of the hill, were almost untouched. And then there was some bad luck, and, you know, there were some entire streets that were wiped out.
It's an important announcement I wonder if I could just make. Here on Palisades Drive, if anybody has a car, and they leave their car, leave the keys in the car, so that we can move your car, so that these fire trucks can get up Palisades Drive.
Yeah.
What's happening is people take their keys with them as if they're in a parking lot. This is not a parking lot. Yeah.
Did you watch on the day of the, or the, I guess the next day of the fires, Steve Guttenberg was begging people to leave their car keys in their cars, and there was all this back.
I saw that.
Was that near your neighborhood?
Yes, I was actually. I had basically one good story to tell about the fire. I shouldn't say good. One memorable story about the fire.
There you go.
Terrible. I'm laughing, but I'm crying inside.
I know.
So we could see the fire when it started because it was very close to our house.
Oof.
And my wife was at work in Malibu. I called her. I said, you know, there's a fire right up the hill. And, you know, we talked about it for a little bit. And I think she texted me and she said, you should leave.
Uh-huh.
And she had packed a fire bag. So we took the fire bag and two dogs and my 15-year-old son got in the car and left. And at that point, there was an evacuation warning in the Highlands, but there was not an evacuation order. You didn't have to leave. They weren't telling you to leave. They're saying, get ready to leave. So anyway, it's this 3-mile, I'm getting to the Steve Guttenberg part. It's a 3-mile drive from our house, or 2.5-mile drive from our house, down out of the Highlands, out of the canyon, to Sunset Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
And this is maybe 11 o'clock. I think the fire started around 10:15 a.m.,
mm-hmm.
maybe 11 o'clock. We get down about a third of a mile from Sunset, and it's gridlock traffic on both sides of the street. Gridlock trying to get out. And before long, everybody says, well, I can get out faster if I go the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's gridlock in all direct, you know, one direction going out, and the fire trucks can't get in. Because people have blocked the only road in, and the traffic is not moving. We were in that spot for about 45 minutes. And the fire started to come to us. It was on one side of the street. You could see it. And that part of the street has palm trees in the median, and the tops of the palm trees started to catch fire. And then palm fronds would fall down, bringing fire with them. And then the fire jumped to the other side of the street. So now we have fire on both sides of the street. And what Steve Guttenberg was talking about was people decided to leave their cars and make a run for it. And they were actually making a walk for it. They weren't running, but they decided to walk out and leaving their cars behind. And my son turned to me and said, should we walk out? And I was like, I guess this is kind of a big moment in life. Like, if we sit here, are we going to be like, are we going to die in this car?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I think we should wait a little bit. I think it might open up, because what are you going to do walking around the Palisades without a car? I mean, there's fire everywhere. But the other thing, I had this memory of one time we were coming home from Palm Springs and there was a brush fire on the side of the highway. And the way that brush fire burned, it was really close to the highway and traffic had to slow down to get past it. And when we went by that brush fire, it was so hot. It was like you're sticking your hand inside an oven. And when we were stuck in that traffic in the Palisades, it was not hot. I could not feel the fire. If I could have felt the fire, I think I might have said, let's leave the car and let's get out of here.
Yeah.
But I couldn't feel it. And I was like, you know, if it gets worse and we start to feel it, then we'll go. But people were leaving their cars there. So finally, when the traffic started to move, you had to kind of weave around these abandoned cars.
Mm.
But then we got out. We got onto Sunset. We drove to Santa Monica. And Santa Monica, the air quality was terrible. But, you know, the stores were still open. I think we went out to breakfast. We went out to breakfast in Santa Monica, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about that traffic jam, though. It was caused because was Sunset going towards Malibu closed? Is that why there was traffic there?
No, people were trying to go both directions on Sunset, but they were mainly trying to go toward the PCH. And that area, on bad rush hour days, that area chokes up pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a choke point in traffic. It made me really angry as I was in it, because I was thinking to myself, you got a neighborhood with 1,000 homes and there's only one road out.
Yeah.
How can you tell yourself that you have an evacuation plan when you know the evacuation plan won't work? And I'm thinking, they just need to carve another road through that forest. And I know the Coastal Commission and everybody will say, how could you possibly do that? There's a mountain lion in there. You're going to destroy the mountain lion's habitat. There's coyotes, you know, there's deer, you know. But, we should have thought of that when you built the neighborhood.
Right.
So I was busy, you know, making a new highway in my head.
Mm-hmm.
which kept me, you know, occupied. But I'll tell you the other thing that happened there, Tony, was I was listening to 1070 KNX News Radio. They were doing an outstanding job covering the fire. And they were talking to someone from our neighborhood who had called in. And this person from our neighborhood said a couple things that weren't true. She just misunderstood a couple things about, I mean, she said that we usually have a evacuation center where people can go at our rec center, but they don't have it at our rec center. And that's, that's unfair. We have to go all the way to Brentwood. And I was like, I think it was Westwood. We have to go all the way to Westwood. And I was like, well, the reason is because the recreation center is in the path of the fire.
Right.
They can't put us there. So I felt like, you know, why don't I just call in and set the record straight? So I called in to KNX, and while we were in that traffic, I did, a little interview with KNX, which actually helped me bring my blood pressure down. I think it relaxed my son, too. I will tell you, if there's, like, Pulitzer Prizes for radio journalism, and I don't think there are, but I think there's something called the Marconis. There's a guy at KNX who should win it. Pete Demetrios is one of their, like, on-scene reporters, and some of the reporting he did from the fires is just amazing. It would make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. I mean, he'd be looking at the fire, and the fire was coming toward him, and he'd be describing the fire, and you're saying to yourself, Pete, get out of there, Pete, get out of there.
Right.
And then, you know, after he gave you, like, two more really good minutes, he'd say very casually, and I think I'm going to have to move back.
So, were there police? Okay, so you're saying I'm still obsessed over this Gutenberg street because there was TV crews there, there were fire crews there. Why wasn't there a police guy there that was directing traffic?
There actually was.
Oh, good.
And the whole time I was there, I said, this is typical LAPD. Anybody out directing traffic? What is wrong with those guys? And you get to the bottom of the hill, there actually was somebody directing traffic.
All right, good.
And I can't tell you if that person was doing a good or a bad job.
Yeah.
And, you know, what relationship it had with the traffic jam. But I know that when we got there, it looked to me like he was doing a good job.
You know, but you also raised a good point about just the PCH in general. And when I first moved here in the 80s, I had a girlfriend who lived in Zuma and I lived in Inglewood. So it was quite a trek to go out there. And and even then, her parents told me that if ever there's a fire or a mudstorm or mudslide or something like that, we're kind of trapped over here. We have a couple of canyon roads that will get us over the hill. But if the fire is on top of the hill, we can't use it. So we're all of us are stuck on the PCH going either north or south. And it sounds like that's the bottleneck that you got involved in.
Yeah, completely. I mean, there's one road in and out of our neighborhood. There is also a fire road out of our neighborhood, but that's where the fire was.
Oh, God.
It was right near the fire road. There's a bunch of neighborhoods like that. There's a neighborhood called Sunset Mesa. That's where Matthew Perry's home was when he died. Mm. That road has... That neighborhood has one road out.
Wow.
And I'm sure lots of Malibu, you know, it's you either take this road or you can't go anywhere.
So you said 20% of the Highlands was burned. How did your house fare?
By the way, that's a guess, 20%. It might be
all right, fair enough.
Our street was about 50-50, about 50% destroyed and about 50% still standing.
Wow.
If you come onto our street, there's 9 houses in a row on our side of the street that burned. Mm. And then there's like 4 houses in a row that didn't burn, and ours is one of those.
Wow.
And I was originally, it's funny how wrong you can be about things in life. I was originally telling people that, you know, we're on the side of this hill and there's all these swirling winds in the canyon. And it must have been that we were protected from the wind. And that's why our house didn't burn, because the wind really did, you know, drive the fire.
Right.
But then when we were visiting the house a couple weeks later, I noticed that the hose had been moved from the front of the house to the back of the house. Mm. Somebody had used the hose. And I'm 99% certain that it was a firefighter, and they used the hose to save our house.
Just a plain old garden hose.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what had happened was we had a hedge between our house and the neighbor's house, and the hedge burned to a crisp.
Mm.
But neither house burned.
Mm-hmm.
And so somehow, you know, they were able to keep that fire from jumping like 8 feet from the hedge to the house.
Wow.
And, you know, I don't know for a fact that they saved our house, but our house didn't burn, and mm-hmm. they used the hose. That's what I know.
Incredible. So, incredible. What kind of damage did your house have?
It's real, real smoky inside. There's a lot of ash and soot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from talking to other people, the ash and soot gets all through your air conditioning and heating and, you know, gets in your attic, it gets in your insulation. And, you know, you have to have a professional cleaning, which the insurance companies call remediation. But they have to come in and do, you know, a professional cleaning of all the spaces in your house where air goes.
Doesn't air go everywhere?
Yeah. But I'm talking about vents and, you know.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The fireplace, you know, the chimney needs to be cleaned.
Yeah.
But then the other stuff is kind of negotiable. Like we have couches and some upholstered chairs and mattresses and curtains and rugs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you throw those away or do you try to clean those? I know most people in our neighborhood intend to throw them away, but some of the insurance companies are saying, oh, we could clean this. We could steam clean this.
Mm.
So, you know, because the last thing you want is, you know, you go back to your house and then 6 months later you develop a nagging cough and somebody says, you know, it looks like there's arsenic in the air in your house.
Right. And in your mattress. I mean, yeah. You know, what a sheet is supposed to protect your nose from all the toxins that are in the mattress.
Yeah. And I would say one thing about this, and I know just enough to be dangerous, but this is not a typical forest fire. This is an urban fire. And the things that burned that are dangerous are like, you know, Teslas. When a Tesla burns, Teslas, you know, there's all kinds of chemicals in there, and there's lithium in the battery and all that stuff.
Yeah.
All the cleaning supplies under your sink, they all burned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, appliances burned, you know, lots and lots of cars burned.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of the chemicals come from. And lithium batteries in particular are pretty toxic.
Right.
So, you know, when you measure for toxicity in the air, they're finding it. They're finding lead, they're finding arsenic, they're finding asbestos, all that stuff. So whatever cleaning takes place has to approach, you know, all that stuff. But I you know, that is a, the better case scenario, that's the better case scenario. The worst case scenario is, you know, your entire house burned down. What are you going to do now?
Right.
And
right.
That's like a 3 or 4 year journey.
Yeah. So I've got friends on both sides of that. Some who've lost their entire homes and some like you who are going through this situation where you're my only friend in the Palisades, as far as I know, who's going through this. But I've got friends in Altadena who for weeks weren't even allowed to look to see.
Yeah.
How long did they make you wait to go to your house?
I think it was 2 or 3 weeks.
So a long time too.
And you know, I remember when you go in the house and it really smells like there's been a fire, but it also smelled because, you know, we had a lot of meat and produce in our refrigerator.
Oh.
That had been sitting there for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks.
Wow.
So that was pretty funky. yeah, it wasn't like we were, you know, dying to get in to get stuff. I mean, you know, it was more curiosity and, you know.
Absolutely.
What's going to be salvageable and, you know.
Yeah.
When can the insurance company get in here and that kind of stuff?
Did you have any idea that your house was okay 2 weeks in?
Yeah, because people were trading around videos that had been taken on the street.
Great.
And, so the fire was, I think it was a Tuesday, it might have been a Monday. But mm-hmm. I assumed, based on what was happening, I assumed our house burned down. And then maybe 24, 36 hours after the fire started, somebody sent us a video of driving down our street, and it was, you know, rubble, 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 our neighbor's house, and then our house.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, house is standing, and not that much exterior damage. I mean, we have this giant palm tree in the front yard. We've always been afraid that the palm tree was going to fall down on the house when the winds got too bad, and the palm tree looked fine.
How is this person able to shoot video? I ask because I feel like first of all, I didn't want to go anywhere near these places out of just respect for everybody, including the responders. But should I be doing this kind of a thing? Should people be?
I don't know. There were different people who had different ways of talking their way in. Mm-hmm. And this is before they had a system. After a while, they developed a system. You had to go to this, you know, set up down at the PCH and wait in line and get a card that proved that you were a resident. Mm. And you had to go get a police escort and show them your card. Before they had that system, some people were getting in by basically saying, you know, I left my cat up there, you know, or I left, you know, whatever. Or we know there were some teenagers who had started some sort of fund to benefit the Palisades, and they were able to get in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, some people got in, and my wife would always say, how come they got in and we didn't?
Right.
I'm like, I don't know. They're better at talking their way past police. I don't
know. By the way, thank you, Peter, for allowing me to talk to you about this. I was very reluctant to talk about either of these areas that have been affected because I didn't want, I don't know, it just seemed a little gross to me to hop on board, especially since the real news has talked about it a lot. But I also feel like the real news has missed out on a lot of questions that I have. And so it's awesome that you're open to talk about this so thank you and I'm very sorry for what you're going through. So one of my questions is right away everybody started going through their closets and wanting to give clothes and whatever we could to the victims, and I would say that you guys are exactly the same as somebody whose house burned down, because now you're either in a rental place or a hotel or something with only the clothes on your back, right?
Yeah. Although there were a lot of people who gave clothing away, or they'd say, come to this place and there's clothing, or there were stores that gave brand new clothing away.
So
we were able to get, clothing pretty quickly. It was a little more of a challenge to get a place to live, because there was just this big scramble for rentals.
Yeah,
we're in the South Bay, and I feel like that's probably been the most popular destination for people from the Palisades is the South Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we wanted to rent a house month to month because we weren't sure when we would be going back to the Palisades, but there were no month to month rentals available. The realtors were all saying it's a year or nothing.
Wow.
You can't rent for a month. So we finally said, oh, the heck with it, we'll rent for a year. But I did want to say, you know, it probably sounds like I'm not very emotional about that, and that's just partly my personality. But, you know, there's something about knowing that your house is gone and that your possessions are gone, and that, you know, certain things that you had an emotional attached to, like maybe it's a wedding picture or a picture of your parents or something, is gone. And there's a finality to it, whereas we're in a little bit of a limbo. Our neighborhood is gone. Our neighborhood will come back. It may not come back for 3 years or 5 years or whatever, but it'll come back. So, you know, I don't think it's as much of a gut punch when, yes, you have to leave, you know, with the clothes on your back, and you have to uproot your routine. And we took one of our kids out of school in the Palisades and put him into school in the South Bay. So it's disruptive and it's inconvenient, but I don't think it's as much of a gut punch as it is to, you know, those people who lost their houses are looking at all kinds of uncertainty and all kinds of questions they don't know the answer to.
That's right. Let me ask you a little bit more about your rental property, because I have seen, and you probably have too, this list of 3,300 rental properties who illegally jacked up the prices. Did you experience some of that gouging when you were looking?
I think we experienced it on, you know, Zillow, but not in person.
Great.
So you would see a house and you would say, oh my God, I can't believe they're asking that. And then you look at the history and they were asking a lot less a month ago.
Right.
But I have a friend, I was with a friend last night and he saw this house that was, I think, you know, rents are very high on the West Side. Mm-hmm. He saw this house that was for rent for like $19,000. It was a nice big house close to the beach. Mm-hmm. And he looked at the history, and it had, before the fire, it was for rent for like $9,000.
Right. Right.
So he went to the open house, and he went to the open house for the sole purpose of walking up to the realtor and saying, "You are a dick."
Good. 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 So, okay. Along those lines, we have a new DA who got on video immediately after the fire and said, "I'm coming after you if you're a looter." Now, obviously, he probably never thought that the landlords would be the major looters of these fires, but they turned out to be that. And I haven't seen a peep from the DA. Has that been on your radar at all?
It's funny. It was on our radar while we were looking for something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I get really angry and resentful about the way the situation was.
Yeah.
And once we found a place, and we found a place that was very reasonably priced. The family we're renting from is, they're great. But once that happened, I was probably less, you know, exercised about it. But I totally agree with you. And you saw that list online, and I saw people talking about it on social media. This is, I might be wrong about this, but I think this is a crime that like teenagers could prosecute.
Right.
You know, you just go to Zillow and you look at the rental history, and if it goes up by more than 10%, the asking price after the disaster, that's price gouging.
And it's such a cruel crime. Not to be a bleeding heart liberal, but if somebody went into your house after you evacuated and stole your golf clubs, that kind of sucks. But these people are shading down people for tens of thousands of dollars a month.
I know.
And I guess what they're going to say is, well, the government's going to give Pete all this money. Why shouldn't we take it? You know?
Yeah.
And it's like, first of all, because it's against the law, but also it's gross.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's legal if you're selling the house, and yesterday the house was $2 million and today it's $3.5 million. I guess that's legal.
Right.
I don't know how that law is written, but if you're renting the house, it's not.
That's right.
I mean, it was, you see good human behavior and you see bad human behavior in the light of this. There has been a lot of really good behavior.
Yes.
Like a bunch of the parents at the high school that my son goes to, down in, it's called MiraCosta High School in Manhattan Beach.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of the parents threw this giant welcoming party for all the Palisades family. And it was just out of nowhere. They just said, you know, come to this giant party. And it was like hundreds and hundreds of people. And just, you know, somebody opened up their backyard and it was, you know, it was delicious food. And
mm-hmm.
all these, you know, people were there to help. The high school principal was there. The mayor of Manhattan Beach was there.
And, wow.
She said, if you get a parking ticket, you bring it to City Hall and you tell them you're from the Palisades.
What?
So, you know, and we've had some good experiences with, you know, restocking like surfboards and wetsuits. My wife has found, you know, different places that were doing either discounts or giveaways for Palisades families.
So, wow.
There's been a lot of, you know, the better side of humanity has come out in a lot of ways.
How has the government, both local and federal, been for you guys?
I think they're trying really hard. And
good.
I think in some areas they're succeeding. I know that the cleanup of a house that burns down is two phases. The first phase is the EPA goes in and takes out what they know to be toxic. Mm-hmm. And then after the EPA goes in, the Army Corps of Engineers or a company that the Army Corps has hired, they go in and they will remove all the debris. They come in with, you know, dump trucks and bulldozers and all kinds of trucks, and they take away everything.
Yeah.
And they either do it for free, or if you have insurance, they say to your insurance company, okay, that costs us $50,000, pay us $70,000. But the resident doesn't have to pay a penny.
Awesome.
And the first half of that, the EPA half of that, went really fast. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure the EPA half of that is over.
Yeah, that's what I heard too.
Yeah. So now they're doing the Army Corps part, and that's going slower. But my understanding is the sort of logjam on that is that the county has to go through some process to confirm that the person who said, yes, go in there and take all the debris away, actually owns the house.
Okay.
And that, for whatever reason, is taking a long time. But there's that. I mean, but they set up, you know, these recovery centers, and you could go in if you lost your driver's license or lost your registration. They'd give you one, or they'd order it for you.
Oh, hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, they put it all under one roof. So FEMA was there. The Red Cross was there.
Wow.
Everybody was there, and you'd go from booth to booth. So that was good. And they're mm-hmm. trying to do something similar with the permitting process for rebuilding, mm-hmm. which is, you know, they put all the permitting, you know, agencies together in one place, mm-hmm. so you can go in and get your permits approved. But again, I know just enough to be dangerous about this. It's my understanding that getting permits, you know, they say you pull a permit. I don't even know what that means, but getting permits pulled is a professional job. That's
right.
That's what your builder or your contractor does. You don't go down there and try to do it because you won't be able to figure it out.
Right. You're the perfect person to ask this question to. Speaking of debris, there's controversy that a lot of the Palisades homes, the debris is being sent to Will Rogers Beach, where your kids call their second home probably, right? And so there's a lot of pushback about that. Where do you stand on this?
Well, they have to put it somewhere. Mm-hmm. They originally were going to take the EPA toxic stuff to Topanga. Mm-hmm. And the people in Topanga got really angry. And I'm pretty sure that's what you're talking about. I'm pretty sure that debris is now going to Will Rogers. And they do, you know, they put a tarp underneath it and, you know, they store it there. And you hope it's, you know, going to be contained and safe. But I think just as kind of controversial as Will is, where are all those destroyed houses going? And
right.
They go in to Calabasas and someplace up sort of north of the Central Valley. And, you know, they're going where landfills are. They're going where landfills are that, you know, have room. But I think read the other day that the amount of debris and basically trash, all these houses have been turned into trash. Mm-hmm. The amount of debris created by these two fires is equal to the amount of debris that the entire county produces in 6 months.
Wow.
It's you know, I have some sympathy to the government. They have to put it somewhere.
Right.
And that's what landfills are for. And if you say, well, why can't you take it out to the desert? You know, mm-hmm. I don't know. There's people who live in the desert, too. You know,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's easy for me to shrug it off because it's not coming to my neighborhood. But this is a whole topic of, you know, who are you angry at? Who do you think screwed up? Who are you blaming?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people probably could have done a better job, but we'll never know whether it would have made a difference. And we hadn't had any rain since April.
Mm-hmm.
So this happened in January. We hadn't had rain since April. So it was dry as a bone. And the winds were 80 miles an hour.
Right.
And the story of wildfires in Southern California is there's only one story, you know. If the wind's blowing, the fire wins. And if the wind's not blowing, the firefighters win.
Mm-hmm.
And the wind was blowing. I just, you know, a lot of things could have been done better.
Right.
I don't know, as we sit here right now, how much difference it would have made.
You're the perfect man to ask this question to, because as my audience has realized you're a very even-keeled, intelligent man who tries to be fair about things. The mayor fired one of the police or one of the fire chiefs this last month, and her reasoning was that the fire chief didn't tell the mayor about the danger of this oncoming windstorm, and so the mayor went to Africa. But it sounds, but I don't know about you, but I remember the National Weather Service telling us there's going to be dangerous winds. Now, I kind of blew it off because we get these from time to time and nothing comes of them. Did you get these messages? Was it easy for you? Did you need, Pete, did you need the fire chief to tell you that?
she never called me.
Right.
We knew that high winds were coming, and people in our family are very sensitive to Santa Ana winds. My wife sometimes gets migraines. Mm. My son sometimes gets migraines when there's Santa Ana winds. So we knew they were coming, and we thought it would be, you know, another sort of, you know, no fun couple of days. But I think that's why my wife, you know, sent me a text and said, you should leave. Mm-hmm. But she knew that there were, she knew that it wasn't just a fire up the hill. It was a fire up the hill when we were expecting, you know, record-setting historic winds.
That's right.
I will say something about the mayor, though, and I'm not particularly pro or con.
Right.
I voted for the other Democrat. Everybody thinks Caruso ran as a Republican. He ran as a Democrat,
mm-hmm.
and I actually voted for him, but I'm not super political about it. She had three reasons she used for firing the mayor, and I thought two were legitimate.
Oh.
One was that on the day of the fire, you know, the fire department had the option of telling people they couldn't go home and they had to keep working.
Mm.
And apparently she didn't use that option the first time she could have.
Mm-hmm.
And so 1,000 guys went home, and when women went home and came, they all came back. But in the immediate aftermath of the fire, they did not have all hands on deck.
Okay.
I think you can second guess that one, but I also think that that's the kind of decision that was probably made by 10 or 15 people. I don't think the fire chief made it by herself.
But also, hold on. Also, to that point, though, wasn't that the night of the 100-mile-an-hour wind? So there wasn't much a lot of these firefighters could do?
Yeah, and they, you know, when the fire's up in the hills, there's only so much water they can get up into the hills. You're pumping it up the hill.
Yeah.
Now, they did have a reservoir that was empty, which is another story.
Right.
And that reservoir is in our neighborhood.
Mm.
That's a little inexcusable. But the other reason the mayor had was, one was she didn't keep all hands on deck, and the other one was she was dragging her feet and didn't want to do a post-mortem on what went wrong and what was right and what was wrong. And I'm confused. There's so many different investigations happening. I'm not sure if the fire department is really expected to do one or if somebody else is doing that investigation for them.
Right.
But it was pretty clear that they were not seeing eye to eye. They were just agreeing with each other. And
in public. I mean, I believe that's why she got fired. She was asked serious questions by the press the day of or the day after, and she was blunt about it. She said the mayor cut our budget by, 18 million, 17 million, something like that.
Yeah.
And I couldn't use that money to get mechanics to fix these 100 fire trucks. Yeah. And what do you want me to do? And I mean, if I had said that in any other job, I would have been fired. Right?
Yeah. And that's not the entire full story on the budget. My source on this is the Los Angeles Times, Tony, where we used to work. The mayor did propose a reduction in the fire department budget. She proposed that. But before the budget was finalized, the city council added money back.
Well, the fire... They wanted to add $50 million back for raises. So you're absolutely right. The bottom line would have been an up for the fire department.
Yeah.
And the new city council president has talked about this a little bit. I think because he wants to run for mayor. But he also is defending the current mayor and why she fired the fire chief.
Hey,
you can't whine about it. You know we were about to give you guys a bunch of raises. But I don't think that was her point. I think her point was, I couldn't hire mechanics before the fire.
I think fire chief did her best, and I think the mayor did her best. And disappointing that the mayor was in Africa. It's disappointing that the fire chief didn't keep everybody working around the clock right away.
Yes.
It's disappointing that the Department of Power and Water, or Water and Power, let that reservoir sit empty for the better part of a year.
Right.
Oh, we're putting out bids to fix the hole in the tarp so that we can use it again.
Yeah.
If you can't do that in a week or two, don't empty the damn thing.
Right. Right. So, okay. So again, you're the most even keeled person I would probably ever get to meet in the Palisades.
Right.
What?
You could get me going on other topics that I would not be even keeled.
But what are your neighbors saying in the Palisades? Are they blaming people? Are they angry? What's going on with them?
Yeah, I think all of the above. I think that a lot of people are angry about the fact that the hydrants, you know, ran out of water and that the reservoir was empty, and you know, that they don't know if the governor did everything the governor could have done to.
They're mad at him too, of course.
Oh yeah, to improve the water supply.
Yeah,
so there are people who are angry, and I don't know what the numbers are, but I know that there are any number of, you know, lawyers who are trying to get together lawsuits. Altadena, the lawsuit I think would be against the power company, and I don't know who you'd sue in the Palisades. I guess you sue the government.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, we lived in New York during 9/11. And which was much more terrifying than the fire.
Which is funny because the picture that you painted of you in that log that traffic jam sounds really scary.
Yeah, it was scary, but my son wasn't afraid. If
Great.
My son had been afraid, I'm not sure I would have been afraid. Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned he was a quarterback on his JV football team. Mm-hmm. And one of his strengths as a quarterback is he stays in the pocket.
God
and takes
bless.
The hit, but, you know, makes the pass. And I said to him afterwards, Finney, you stayed right in the pocket.
Wow.
You had poise under pressure. I was so proud of him. But if he had freaked out, I'm not sure if I would have been able to help hold it together.
Well, and thank God you raised a quarterback who isn't a scrambler.
Yeah, that's true. Tom Brady did pretty well without scrambling.
He would have been fine. Randall Cunningham, dead on the PCH.
Yeah, exactly. But you asked me a question I didn't answer. What was the question?
I think I was asking about your neighbors. Are your neighbors pissed?
Oh, yeah. I think they're, particularly, you know, people who lost their houses are, you know, they're coming from a different place than we are.
Yeah.
I think people are angry. A lot of people are angry at their insurance companies. They're angry about all the different delays. They want to rebuild now.
Mm-hmm. And
whatever delay stands in front of them. I know there's going to be a bunch of lawsuits. Oh, I know what I was about to say about 9/11. I thought one of the good things about 9/11 is that pretty soon after 9/11, I don't know if it's Congress or the Bush administration or both of them, they appointed a special master to figure out how to compensate the victims. And it was, you know, the government sort of figured out, you know, how should we try to, you know, repay people so they're not going to want to go sue somebody.
Mm-hmm.
The goal of that was to prevent everybody from suing each other. Oh, I'm suing the Port Authority. Oh, I'm suing this person. I'm suing that person.
Yeah.
And they thought that would be, you know, just a really bad thing for the country if 9/11 devolved into a bunch of lawsuits.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, that's my personal opinion is I want to move through this and be done with it. I don't want to, like, be deposed and filing a lawsuit and all this other kind of stuff.
Did that technique work in New York?
Yeah, the guy's name was Ken Feinberg, and he was a really brilliant lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the total amount of money, but they, you know, they put together billions of dollars, and it was, mm-hmm. you know, New York was over 3,000 people died.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, it was a significant, you know, undertaking, and I think the private sector also did a lot. There were a lot of scholarships given to children of people who died. But, you know, even today, there's still some unfinished business relating to the diseases.
That's
that,
right.
You know, firefighters got at ground zero. So,
we've seen these rock concerts where they've raised hundreds of millions of dollars for the fire victims. Does somebody whose house didn't burn down but is like you said, in this limbo. Are you eligible for any of that or what?
You know, that's another thing that, you know, you said, what are my neighbors talking about? That'll get them going. Is, you know, why don't they just give that money to the 10 or 12,000 families who lost their houses?
Right.
And I don't think anything like that is happening. I know the Red Cross is giving money to people whose houses burned down.
Right.
And I don't know at what level. But the concert they had at SoFi, they made an announcement of who they were giving the money to. And it was like, you know, it was 15 or 20 really well-meaning, you know, community groups. But
yeah.
It wasn't the individuals.
No.
And I guess the idea is that through those community groups, the money will get where it needs to go. But, you know, there is some concern about not the people who lost their houses, but the people who lost their jobs. They
that
worked
too.
At those houses.
That too.
Taught at those schools or whatever.
Yeah.
But I know that I went down to that, you know, Everything Under One Roof Center where they had FEMA and everybody else there. And I saw one of my neighbors and I told him what I was doing there. And he said, what are you doing here? He said, you really want to know? I said, yeah, I want to know. I said, I'm going to every single booth and I'm saying, whatever money you're raising, give it directly to the people who lost their houses.
Great. Great. I mean, we know.
I don't think that's happening. Because
we know trickle down never works.
Oh yeah.
It never works. Even if these are well-meaning people, they all have staffs, they all have presidents, they have all CEOs, and it's like, it, I mean, God bless the owner of the Clippers, Steve Ballmer. who matched dollar for dollar everybody that was giving money during those concerts, and of course he owns those two facilities that it was at. And I mean, it's nice to see that we do have some good billionaires in this country. But you're absolutely right. It needs to go directly to the people, and it seems like it's easy to know who the people are.
Yeah, I mean, you have satellite images of their houses. Everybody knows who everybody is these days.
Right.
Yeah. Have you been to the Clippers' new arena?
I have. I've Ubered people there.
Okay. So I'm just saying. Everybody knows who everybody is. When you walk into the arena, they greet you by name.
Because of the facial recognition?
Yeah, there's something that pops up in front of them and says, this is Tony Pierce. And the
woman
looks up and she says, good to see you, Mr. Pierce.
Yeah,
like, oh,
yeah. I know.
But,
it is.
But I, you know, my view on something like this is it's pretty traumatic. It's pretty difficult. It's pretty, it throws you off your game. And your goal is to get through it and not, you know, not just be, you know, not let it stop you in your tracks and change the trajectory of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I don't want to be angry about it. I just want to, you know, go through it and you know, move past it. Because I just think, you know, the anger and the blaming and all that stuff, it just gets, it's really exhausting.
Right.
It's really exhausting.
So you've got three kids and a wife.
Yep.
No disrespect to your beautiful wife, but I'm a little nervous about the kids because it's just hard to be a kid anyways. And so you've got a 21-year-old who's your oldest. How old is your youngest?
He's 15.
Okay. This has to be traumatic to them, right?
Yeah, although, you know, my belief is, I think I'm right about this, that it would be more difficult for younger children.
Right.
Because older children, at the very least, they can articulate, you know, their thoughts and but my kids, you know, we think of this generation of kids as really coddled by helicopter parents and, you know, spoiled and they've got iPhones and everything. They have been through a lot.
Right.
I mean, they go to school, and once or twice a year, they have to practice running from shooters.
Yeah,
In a zigzag pattern, which you know, we never practiced that when I went to school.
No way.
You know, living in LA, we've had all kinds of fires that have been, you know, this one was obviously the biggest and the baddest and the worst. But we've had a bunch of fires over a long period of time. They lived through the pandemic,
right?
Which was, you know. For a child, I mean, everything was upside down. You couldn't even go to school.
Right.
You couldn't go ride your bike with your friends. I mean, so they've been through a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as I can tell, they're doing pretty well, but we kind of my wife and I have a sense that we have to give them some space and you know, some grace. You know, we can't be nagging our son about his homework every night.
Right.
The way we might have been if we were still up in the Palisades.
Are they able to surf down there in the South Bay?
There is good surf down here. I think the best wave down here is El Porto in Manhattan Beach, but
good.
we have not been in the water. The water's been pretty dirty.
Oh,
certainly the water up at the Palisades is pretty dirty.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, but I think the water down here is okay.
Uh-huh.
We just, you know, you talk about an idyllic world and what was lost.
Yeah.
My two kids at Pali High were in the surf class at Pali High. There is a class at Pali High where you surf in the morning for credit. It's your phys ed class. And the surfing starts at 8:30 and you surf till about 9:15 or 9:30.
Wow.
And then you have an hour to go home and take a shower and then go to school and be at school at 10:30. And a lot of the time when I was working at home, I would have hot breakfast on the table when they came home from surfing.
Of course.
You know, scrambled eggs and pancakes. And, you know, they'd come in all, you know, wet, cold from surfing. And it was 100% perfect.
Yeah.
And I don't think I realized at the time, this is great. This might be as good as it ever gets.
Right. Right.
But, down here, they have high school surf down here, but it starts at 6:30.
Oh.
And I cannot get my kids out of bed at 6:30. These Manhattan Beach kids are hardcore about their surfing.
So your daughter is at Pali High.
Yep.
Even though you live down in the South Bay, how does that work out?
Well, Pali High is still virtual. So
okay.
She goes to school on the computer at like 8:30 in the morning, and
mm-hmm.
you know she can be in her pajamas. She can, you know, snack on some breakfast. But
it's
all virtual.
So it's back to COVID days for her.
Yeah, pretty much. And you know. This isn't a political statement at all. This is just based on our family's experience.
Mm-hmm.
Virtual school is not a good option.
Right.
It's not a good option for our children, and we learned that in the pandemic. It's just, I think particularly boys, they need an in-person experience. They need someone to be able to look them in the eye and say, calm down and, you know, or pay attention, or whatever it is. And
mm-hmm.
so that's why with our younger son, we moved him to a school that's in person.
Okay, good.
Not that we thought he would, you know, just sort of, you know, screw off and not learn anything.
Right.
I just don't think it's the best way to learn.
Well, you also have extremely active kids. I mean, two of your kids not only are surfers, but golfers. Like, they are out all the time doing stuff.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, when you're in that virtual environment, you know you're missing out on something.
Yes.
You know, you don't get to see anybody between classes, and you know, you don't have the same kind of personal interaction with your friends and your teachers, and it's not the same. And you know,
so
it's unfortunate that, you know, Palisades High had to do that. I think most of the other public schools in the Palisades were able to go back in some fashion.
Right. The destruction of Pali High is really bad. Is that what it is?
You know, it actually wasn't that bad. And there were these false reports on the night of the fire that Palisades High has been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't destroyed. The main buildings and the football stadium are in pretty good shape, but they have these, you know, like every school in California that started with a nice building, but then they have a bunch of trailers in the backyard.
Right. Right.
Those they don't call them trailers, but those classrooms were damaged.
Yeah,
and you know they have work to do to fix that in the high school. And this, you know, the city will have different standards of the kind of work they have to have done. It won't be won't be the same as fixing up your garage.
Right. Santa Monica announced that the old Sears building, right yep. by the pier there, will be open for Pali High students. Has that happened yet?
No. What I saw yesterday, and Palisades High is really good about communicating. Well, I saw a note from the principal saying that they have identified that. That's the spot they want. They're working on it. They think it's going to be doable. They think it's going to happen, mm-hmm. but it hasn't been finalized. It hasn't been okay. finalized yet.
All right.
And, you know, there's all these, you know, regulations about what a school has to have, you know, mm. exit signs and fire extinguishers and earthquake, you know, retrofit and all these different things. And you just hope that on some of those things, there's some wiggle room.
Right. Let me ask you why your daughter is choosing virtual Pali High instead of going to school in the South Bay.
Oh, she's a senior. This is the end of her high school. She's been there for 3.5 years.
Okay.
She wants to graduate with her friends.
Perfect.
She doesn't want to graduate with a bunch of people she doesn't know.
That sounds great. Because, I mean, you just made MiraCosta sound like the greatest high school in all of L.A. right now. And so
it is a good high school. It is a good high school. Yeah.
Okay. So.
But Pali High is a great school, too.
Oh, of course. Yeah. So some of my friends whose house have burned down, they have GoFundMes. The friends of mine whose houses didn't burn down, they have GoFundMes because they obviously have lots of expenses yeah. that aren't necessarily covered by insurance right away. Are you guys doing a GoFundMe too?
You know, it's funny you should ask because we were not, and we didn't even think about it or anything. And then, like, I don't know, 10 days ago, 8 days ago, a friend of mine who I worked with in New York in the 1990s texted me and said, I'd like to do a GoFundMe for you. And my first response was, I'm not sure I want that. And I said to my wife, would you be okay with that? She said, of course. I went back to him. I said, yeah, we're fine with it. And he was a little perplexed about why I was hesitant in the first place.
Yeah.
And he's one of these guys, he just has sort of a wisdom about him. And he said, you know, independence is fine, but sometimes in life you have to let people help you. I'm glad he told me that because, you know, then I learned something from it, which is, and people do want to help. They feel terrible. I mean, you're sitting in Boston or New York and seeing all these images.
Mm-hmm.
So, we some friends did a GoFundMe just in the last 10 days. And it was really humbling to see names from, you know, my distant past.
Obviously I'll link to the GoFundMe on the blog post that I'll have for this, but for people who are only going to listen to this, is there an easy way for them to reach your GoFundMe?
I don't know. Okay. I think if you link to it, I mean, I think it says Viles Family in the name. If you search for Viles Family and go
okay.
find me. I think we'd probably be the only Viles family out there.
Great. And so it's spelled like it sounds. V-I-L-E-S.
You got it. No, if somebody's listening to this and they're in a bad place because of the fires and it doesn't sound like I'm in a bad place, I guess, you know, I apologize a little bit because I apologize. You can't apologize a little bit. I apologize for sounding like I might not be all that considerate. I do totally get it. And I just think different people process and experience these things differently. And like I said, if you lost your house, that's a whole different kind of gut punch. Just, you know, for us, we were like, okay, what do we have to do next?
Yeah.
And there's been some times where we've said, you know, this really sucks. Like, you know, being in the situation where we needed to rent a place for a year and we don't know how much of that insurance is going to pay for. And we're going to have, you know, a mortgage and rent. But you know what? You know, we'll figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like most of the time people do overcome these unexpected situations. And I feel like you're going to be more successful if you treat them with as little emotion as possible.
Yeah, it's funny that I have this friend who's a realtor on our street. He's my realtor, and he's got three boys, and he's always trying to sort of teach his boys life lessons. And I saw him after the fire. His house burned down, and they had just renovated it. Mm. And he said, "I told my boys, this isn't something that happened to us. This is something that happened for us."
Hmm.
And I was like, "Whoa." But, you know, it certainly pushes your life in a new direction.
Yeah.
And I think you just have to sort of go with it the best you can. And, you know, for us, we've never lived in the South Bay. It's a great place to live.
Mm-hmm.
My son, the golf team at MiraCosta, is probably a little better than the golf team at the Palisades. So
ooh.
He has to play better to, you know, be good enough to get, you know, into the matches.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that sounds really trivial. That's important to him right now.
That's his first world of a problem as we can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a total first world problem.
It would be crazy for me not to ask you this since you are a real estate expert. So many houses. What do you say, 10,000 houses gone?
I'd say 10 or 12,000, yeah.
What does that do to the real estate market in L.A. for the next couple of years?
You know, it makes it, the realtors always say frothy, but it makes it uneven. You know, wherever, and let's just say of those 10,000 people, you know, maybe half of them are going to rebuild, so all they need to do is rent for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some of them are going to buy other houses. That's going to drive up the price of houses in some neighborhoods, mm-hmm. in the neighborhoods where those people are going. Some people are really going to have a hard time. They may not have the insurance coverage, and LA is a hard place to get your feet under you.
Mm-hmm.
It's expensive. So, you know, I think you're going to continue to hear about it for a long time. You know, some people will have a lot of resources and settle pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
Some people won't. You know,
right.
If you think of families that have lived in houses for a long time, they're house rich. I mean, they might live in a house that's worth $800,000 or $1.5 million, but they couldn't afford to go out and buy a house for $800,000
right.
or $1.5 million, and now that house is gone.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be hard for those people. I think the city, county, state government are going to try to do the right thing to help them.
Good.
And I imagine the federal government will be there too, but it's hard to predict anything about our federal government these days.
It is. It is.
But I think it's going to be a long struggle for a lot of people. And so you're going to hear about this a year or two from now, and you're going to say, really, still? And the answer is yes, really, still.
Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that one third of the people are going to sell their houses right away. That traditionally, this is what happens when a massive fire hits a neighborhood or a community. And these are two communities that were hit in a giant way. The number was one third just sell right away because either they're old or they just don't want to deal with it. It's just a pain in the ass, and they're just like that first person that sold their house for 550, or not house, but they sold their burned land in Altadena for 550,000 grand, where they were asking for 450, and it was a very small lot. Just like, fine, screw it, take it, I'm out. Then another third try to rebuild, and after a couple of years, they realize how tedious it is, how expensive it is, how hard it is, and they just give up. And these people who are trying to buy their homes are relentless. You've probably gotten phone calls already, I bet.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And so those people are relentless, and they just finally just give it up and say, fine. And then only one third, they say, actually rebuild their house. And so that just changed the dynamics of these neighborhoods by so much. And I would think that in Altadena, the demographics are obviously going to change a lot more because there's so many minorities who have lived there historically over the decades. But then I think about the Palisades. Like, Is it just different wealthy people? Is it more international wealthy people? Who do you think is going to be that two-thirds? If those numbers stay true to the Palisades as well, do you think that your neighborhood is going to change drastically in the next 5 years, let's say?
I think there will be some pretty big changes. I don't know if the sort of population or demographics will change that much, but some people, you know, who are underinsured, and I think a lot of people are underinsured, they don't have enough insurance coverage to build back the same kind of house they had.
Wow.
And I think you'll see different kinds of housing. Like, people I know are talking about prefab housing that's a lot cheaper because the cost to rebuild is going to be really high.
Yeah.
There's not enough labor, there's not enough building materials, et cetera. So it's going to drive up the cost of rebuilding. And, you know, some people, you know, were already underinsured. So what are those people going to do? I think some of them are going to build less expensive houses. And, you know, the neighbors won't be thrilled because they want their property value to stay up. So I think it's going to be a little bit of, I don't think it's going to be one consistent narrative. I think a lot of different things are going to happen. Mm-hmm. But the Palisades, it's a remote place. It's not on the way to anywhere. It's expensive. I think it'll probably sort of keep its character as a affluent, secluded bedroom community.
Yeah.
You know, you can't get anywhere from there. It's not on the way to anything. It's not. I mean, there's no shortcut that takes you through the Palisades.
Right.
And Altadena, I don't know as well, but I do know there was a sort of, you know, long-standing minority community, and it seems to be that community is at risk of, you know, not being able to come back and sort of reassemble itself.
That's right.
And we do have a housing problem in L.A.
I mean, that too.
This is going to make it a little bit worse, or maybe even a lot worse. But you know, it's just so hard to build in L.A. So there's not enough buildings. So there's not enough housing.
My mom was asking me about these fires, and I told her every time that I play the lottery, I think if I win, where am I going to buy my house? And it was all the places that got burned. Malibu, Palisades, and Altadena. You know, if I'd won the billion, I'd have three houses, and those were either where they would be. So I think to your point that it doesn't go anywhere. I think it's because that's the final destination. This is the last place this is the end of the American dream. This is where you want to be, right? There's no other, I mean, other than maybe Maui next door to Oprah. I don't think there's a better end of your hopes than living by the beach and having your kids surf at the end of the road, right?
Yeah. No, it's a special place. And I think in our sort of darker moments, we are like, oh my God, it'll never be like it was. And, you know, we'll never have back what we lost. And talking about the neighborhood and not our house. But, you know, the ocean will still be there, and the hills will still be there. The mountains will still be there. And I think the community will come back. I don't think it'll come back exactly the same. But I hope it comes back as close to the same as it can. You know, there are a lot of people who live in the Palisades who grew up there, who are not hedge fund managers or celebrities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I hope that those people can stay.
Right.
And don't get sort of elbowed out of the way.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of people who want to do the right thing. I think, you know, our city councilor, Tracy Parks, has been extremely visible and accessible. I think she wants the neighborhood to be as healthy as it can be. And I'm sure that's true about
how
Venus
great was Peter. You know who we'd give our clothes to if they were smoked out of their homes? Our Patreons. So shout out to Nancy Rommelman, Sean Atlow, Matt Mills, Sean Wallace, Greg and Molly, Jamie Taylor, Mark Johnson, Kira Ann, Barney Grinke, Ben Welsh, Jen Adams, Trevor Wilson, Bree Wild, Dougie Gyro, Christina Up North, Robin Carey, Adam Shorn, Ben from Down Under, Chris from the ATX, Gregor, Phil, and Callie. To be a Patreon, just go to patreon.com/hereinLA. Want to support us, but now you just want to empty your piggy bank for Pete and his family? Completely understood. In fact, if you do go to his GoFundMe and type in Vile's family, The one that you want is the one set up by Bruce Francis. If you want to stoke us, here's a way that won't even cost you a nickel. We're moving our web home from Medium to Substack, in part because once we get there, we can email you every episode every time we publish. Super easy. Substack has tiers where you can throw us some cash, but for the most part, I want this to be a free experience. So if you go to hereinla.substack.com and sign up before the end of March, I will upgrade your free trial to a 6-month paid VIP tier that won't cost you anything. VIP will get you bonus things like extra posts and slightly more info in the episodes. All the tiers will have the audio of the podcast. I'm not trying to become a millionaire off of this, but I do want to give something a little special to those who pay. Experience that for free by signing up now. Here in LA is produced by and edited by Tony Pierce. Music supervision by Jordan Katz. Songs by Orgone and Jordan Katz. Special thanks to Cindy for creating the logo, Jen for inspiring this, and I believe Meredith Artley, who hired Peter at the LA Times, who also hired me. And I'm so grateful I got to meet him there. Also, I'm grateful for all of you for making it through this entire episode. As you could hear, the sound quality was a little odd because I had to call Pete using the telephone, and it's all on one channel, and it doesn't sound as good as it normally does, but you made it all the way to here, and I love you!